Hi, folks. Denise Howell here. And next on This Week in Law, we're joined by Simon Tam of The Slants. He's going to talk with us about his success at the Supreme Court, the end of the disparagement clause, and the rise of free speech, and really the whole punk rock opera that he has been through in pursuing his case for 8 years. You're not going to want to miss this next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiT, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Mike Keyes, and Matt Curtis. Episode 392, recorded June 30th, 2017. The episode that shall not be named. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. We've been waiting for this show for a while, and we're thrilled that the day we can do it has arrived. Our guest today is Simon Tam. Simon is a Portland musician, record label founder, and former band member of the Stibs, and for the last 11 years, frontman with the Slants, who you may be familiar with from their wonderful tunes and also from the fact that they have been involved in lengthy litigation over their ability to trademark their name, the Slants. So, Simon, welcome to the show. It's so great to have you on.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
The reason we can have Simon on now is because last week, on Monday the 19th, the United States Supreme Court resolved his case after the long, winding legal road that he has been on. And we want to get into that with him here today on the show. To do that with us as well are my wonderful co-hosts. Mike Keyes is here. Hello, Mike.
Hello, Denise. Great to be here with you. And really thrilled that Simon's with us today. This is going to be a lot of fun.
Me too. Mike rushed back from court so he could join us here today. So we're thrilled to have you too, Mike. And Matt Curtis is here. Matt is our law school intern and co-host as well. Hi.
Hi. Great to be here and great to be here with Simon. And I did finally make it to the Game of Thrones bar, and it is wonderful.
Oh, good to know. Good to know. I may have to fly out to D.C. at some point this summer.
August 28th it shuts down. So.
Oh, no. Okay. We'll shelve that. Let's get right into talking about the case. Now, we've covered the Slants case, which is now called Mittal versus Tam. It changed names partway through the litigation because the head of the USPTO changed. Am I pronouncing that right, Mike? How do you pronounce the name of the head of the USPTO?
I have heard it pronounced that way, yes.
Mittal.
I've heard multiple pronunciations.
M-A-T-A-L. So this decision we've talked about on the show before, but in case you are not – in fact, we've had Simon's lawyer on the show before, Ron Coleman, but the case was still pending, so we couldn't go into any – great detail, or I can't recall if we went into any detail at all with Ron about the case while it was pending, because the last thing you want to do is do anything that can impede your ability to prevail in court. So we certainly didn't want to put Simon in that position at all while the case was pending, but it's not pending anymore. Simon has won, and won big. They get to call themselves the Slants. They get to have their federal trademark registration in that name. Simon, why don't you start by letting us know why that was so important to you? Because I'm sure you've heard over and over again from attorneys along the way, nobody's telling you that you can't call yourself the Slants. Why is the registration important?
Well, a trademark registration is important for people engaged in the marketplace because it offers additional protections to their brands. There's certain benefits, in particular for artists. It's important because a lot of times major record label deals and sync licensing deals are hinged upon having a trademark registration. But that being said, for us, it's been a lot bigger than just a trademark registration. If it was only about that, I imagine we probably would have given up many, many years ago because mm-hmm. of how expensive and how long of a process it is. We chose to fight because we believed that it was really important for communities to decide what's best for themselves and not be subject to the arbitrary opinions of an examining attorney at the USPTO. And so we chose to fight because we were challenging the government. They had their full power, the full weight of the government, denying us our rights, and they were hinging all of that evidence on a joke website, urbandictionary.com. That was the only bit of evidence that they had that anyone could possibly find the name The Slants to be disparaging. And so it kicked off a long, kind of more philosophical and ethical battle than anything else of deciding, do we allow this office to make those decisions for our community? What happens when our community disagrees? Because no matter how much evidence we brought to the table saying, hey, we're not offensive to ourselves, it would never be good enough to meet their kind of arbitrary standards.
Right. And it seems like you have been frustrated all along waiting for the USPTO to tell you who in the Asian American community or the Asian community at large was actually offended by your band's name, that it was hard to find anybody who was going to raise their hand and say, yes, the naming a rock band, The Slants, offends me.
And that's correct. And they had many opportunities to. And even though we'd supplied them with independent national surveys, dictionary experts, multiple community organizations that stood up, they said that all of that wasn't good enough. That they mm-hmm. said, well, hey, we found this dictionary from 1937. It lists slant as possible offensive slang. We have urbandictionary.com, of course. And they included photos of Miley Cyrus pulling her eyes back in a slant-eyed gesture. And all that was supposed to be more valid than the actual community itself, which, of course, is paternalistic and offensive.
Right. So it was very important to you, it sounds like, personally and societally. It's also important, and your lawyers, I'm sure, were telling you this from a business standpoint, as you were pointing out, there are benefits to having a trademark registration that you were deprived of, and there is legal authority that the USPTO was relying on to deprive you of it. And that's why there was this back and forth with them about whether or not your mark actually violated this provision of the law that USPTO was relying on. And what happened last week was that provision or parts of it, and Mike, I want to get into that with you, were held to be unconstitutional by the US Supreme Court. So, Mike, why don't we kick it to you now to bring us up to speed on what exactly the PTO was relying on. Tell us about 15 U.S.C. Section 1052.
Sure. So 1052 is a portion of the Lanham Act, also known as Section 2, or more precisely, Section 2A of the Lanham Act. And Section 2A of the Lanham Act has a number of provisions upon which an examiner is required to examine a trademark registration and see if it overcomes some of these hurdles that would allow the examiner to deny the registration. For example, in Section 2A, there is a provision that used to prohibit registration of an offensive or disparaging name. That was precisely the issue or the provision that was at issue in Simon's case. There's other provisions in Section 2A that deal with immoralist or scandalous marks. Those are not subject to registration. We can talk about in a moment whether that provision still survives in light of the court's decision. Still other portions of Section 2 prohibit registration of marks that contain a U.S. flag. And also, I think, the signature and or image of a president, something akin to that. So there's a number of prohibitions at issue in Section 2A, but the one specifically that was at issue is in Simon's case is the one that prohibits disparaging registrations. That provision, and Simon can probably articulate this better than just about any trademark lawyer out there, but that provision had been interpreted by the courts and the PTO that if the mark at issue would be disparaging to a substantial composite of the referenced community, then that would be sufficient for the PTO examiner to reject the application. And so everything that Simon was just mentioning a moment ago about how they gathered a lot of evidence during the process to show that this would not be offensive or disparaging to a substantial composite of the Asian American community. That was really important evidence during the legal battle. So that kind of provides the framework for what was at issue.
Right. And we've been following this case because it's been rattling around in the courts. Simon filed their trademark application, had it declined, and then appealed that to the Federal Circuit. And the Federal Circuit found essentially what the Supreme Court found last week, that the PTO should not be making decisions like this on the grounds that it was making them, that the PTO was wading into muddy, muddy waters that impinged on our First Amendment rights of free speech. So we can talk about that a little bit more in a moment. But first, I want to get into this idea of what's disparaging and what's not, and why this was so problematic to have the PTO attempting to struggle with decisions like this and coming back to Simon with an explanation drawn from the Urban Dictionary and photos of Miley Cyrus. Simon has an op-ed in the New York Times, a Supreme Court decision, Simon, and an op-ed in the New York Times all in the same week. That's a big week right there. And it leads off with an anecdote that is really, really powerful that explains why you named the band what you did, or how you weren't thinking about this when you were 11. You weren't thinking about what you were going to name the band. But this experience that you had when you were 11 influenced you. Can you tell us, our listeners, about that experience, please?
Sure. This happened actually when I was in junior high school, and I was responsible for cleaning up kind of the sports equipment left over from recess. And so I just kind of stayed back to pick up basketballs, volleyballs, and that sort of thing. I remember having a lot of trouble fitting in at the elementary school and middle school as well, because kids would pick on me for my ethnicity. It didn't really kind of went beyond, you know, people making fun of me until it got kind of violent. And that was the experience that I wrote about. I was hanging back, putting things away, and I didn't notice, but another group of students actually stayed back as well. They kind of hid. I didn't find out till I was pushed to the ground and then found, you know, sand and dirt being kicked into my eyes, people kicking me in the stomach, all while yelling Jap and Gook over and over again. And I didn't really know what to do until at one point I just finally snapped and I said, I'm a chink. Like, if you're going to be racist, at least do it correctly. Like, that's how stupid you are. You don't even know how to be a racist properly. And they immediately stopped. They left me alone. And I realized there was just a lot of power in claiming an identity and claiming words and saying that you can't use those against me. Those belong to me and my community. And it was something that just stopped people in their tracks. They just were really shocked. And I kind of had similar experiences throughout my life. But the Slants is kind of one of those things that, you know, when I was trying to think of band names, I asked people around me, you know, what's something you think all Asians have in common? And they would almost always say slanted eyes, which I think is really interesting because, first of all, it's not true. Not all Asians have slanted eyes, and Asian people are not the only people on earth with any kind of slant to their eyes. But more importantly, I thought, what a great way to pay homage to the work of Asian American activists who've been using Slant in this kind of self-empowering way for decades now. We could really honor their work while talking about our perspective or our slant on life, if you will, of what it's like to navigate the entertainment industry as people of color. And so it became kind of this badge of pride, like the very same thing that was used against me to cause me shame and embarrassment, and the very thing that caused all that bullying, now all of a sudden was something that I could say, you know what, I shouldn't be ashamed of this, and that other people shouldn't be ashamed of it as well.
Yeah, that story so tore me apart when I read it. Number one, that you had to go through it. Number two, that it happened in San Diego, California, just down the road basically from where I live. And I think of Southern California as a really culturally diverse and accepting place. And the fact that it happened to you when you were 11, which was not that long ago. you were born in 1981, I believe. So says Wikipedia. to me, that feels like just how can, you know, the fact that that could happen, where it happened and when it happened, really rocked me. And really, I think, is powerful in telling the story of why you wanted to name the band what you did, both from a a business practicality standpoint and from a personal and social health standpoint. From a business practicality standpoint, Mike, that registering a trademark is not something that is divorced from what we do here on the show at all. It's really critical in how people have an online identity as well. It's really critical. For example, the band has the trademark. Well, now they've had the domain theslants.com, and now that they will be able to have the trademark, that gives that domain much more sticking power, doesn't it?
That's right. I mean, when you have a trademark registration, as Simon was alluding to, you have certain benefits not only in the marketplace vis-a-vis third parties, but in the eyes of the law. You actually have enhanced benefits that you can take advantage of as a result of having that registration. For example, in any court proceeding where you would go to enforce your trademark rights, if you have a federal registration issued by the government, you can walk into court and that mark is presumed to be valid, meaning that you have preemptive nationwide rights with respect to that trademark registration because the federal government has given it to you. And that's a pretty powerful piece of evidence that one can have when you go into court. You don't have to establish that the mark is valid. So in terms of enforcing trademarks, that's always a real benefit to have. Another benefit that you get with registration is you get certain enforcement benefits. For example, you could take your registration if you were concerned about infringing goods coming in from overseas or elsewhere. You know, you can take that registration and take it to customs, and they can assist you with enforcement efforts. So that's another benefit that the statute provides. I can also tell you from my own personal experience in helping clients that have infringing activities that are taking place online. A lot of big companies that are in the business of providing content and otherwise, they will take a demand much more seriously if you can show that it's being sent on behalf of a client who has a trademark registration or a family of registrations. It's just considered more powerful and more persuasive. So this isn't a theoretical or hypothetical type of situation that Simon was dealing with here. This is really real life consequences that are pretty significant when it comes to a federal registration. Not to mention all the business reasons that Simon just mentioned, it's important for label purposes and others if you have a registration. It shows it gives you certainly an air of legitimacy versus others.
Right. And there are other ways of identifying oneself with a trademark that might not be governed by the Lanham Act, but instead might be governed by site-specific terms of use and guidelines. I'm curious, Simon, whether Twitter or any other social media platform or anyone else, any private entity, has ever given you flack about using the name The Slants on their site.
No, we've never had any issues with that, just like we've never had any complaints by anyone in the Asian American community either. Mm-hmm. So as far as our use of the name, it's always been fine. And I think for most people, it's not really controversial. And in terms of social media, it's always been totally fine because we've been able to register the usernames pretty early on.
Right. Well, I'm for your sake glad you have the trademark, because you might someday encounter some site that takes the same position as the USPTO was taking, and now you can go to them and say, look, we registered our federal trademark. In fact, we got that provision of federal law declared unconstitutional. And before we dive into that constitutional discussion, what this decision actually says and what the fallout of it is, maybe now's a good time to take a break, and not a break from our discussion or this topic, but a break into what you don't get to do a lot of, Simon, in going around and telling people about why you've done what you've done. You don't get to highlight your music enough, I think. So I think we should do that right now. There's a great track on the band's EP that is called The Band Who Must Not Be Named, that's called Level Up, that I feel is just tailor-made for our audience here at the Twit Network and here at This Week in Law. So why don't we just launch into that, and you guys can enjoy some music by The Slants.
Right now, believing anything is possible. Oh, since I laid my eyes on you, I've got the moves you're moving to.
So I love this, Simon. It's sort of a love story in an arcade.
There's no mistaking the times. Yeah, we're all kind of geeks at heart, so
this is
kind of our homage to that as well.
A lot of your audience or your gigs that you've played in the past have involved anime conventions, and a geeky audience is nothing that you're unfamiliar with.
That's right. Actually, before we were known as the band in court, we were known as the band that would play at anime conventions. Mm-hmm. A lot of times, like our first big break was on NPR's All Things Considered 2009, and they said how we were the band that was conquering stereotypes about Asian Americans while building a geek army. Now that we actually tour and play law schools and IP law conferences, we're building a different kind of geek army, but geeky nonetheless.
That's fantastic. Victor, if we can cut to about the 2-minute mark of the video, there's a wonderful segment here that I don't want to deprive our audience of enjoying here on our show. So there we go. Let the dance fight begin. Too cool. All right, we'll let you catch the rest of this and more Slants music after our show today, but we'll get back into the legal weeds here and discuss what many commentators are calling the most important free speech case in many, many years. That particular comment was made by Professor Hansen from Fordham, who wrote up this case for the esteemed SCOTUS blog. And the outcome of the case. And he hits on what I think many trademark scholars and practitioners are curious about here, The court went through and looked at the provision that we discussed earlier, Section 2 of the Lanham Act, Section 2A in particular, and held it. It went through, and goodness, as I was reading through this decision, I kept scratching my head, wondering how the clerks and justices who wrote this up would not have used more precise language, because I think they left kind of a confusing outcome here for courts to follow in the future. Because they keep referring to Section 2A as the disparagement clause, or what they actually keep referring to is just simply the disparagement clause. And arguably the disparagement clause is just a part of Section 2A, which is kind of long and has many sub-clauses and includes a bar on scandalous and immoral marks, as Mike was discussing earlier, in addition to disparaging marks. So you could take this decision as saying, okay, just the disparagement clause is out the window. And if things are scandalous and immoral, then the USPTO could still reject them on that ground. But that's problematic, because scandalous and immoral is just as amorphous as disparaging, and it might be hard to have the disparagement part stricken and have scandalous and immoral remain. What Professor Fordham writes is that the court reserved the right for the Solicitor General to distinguish this case and argue that the PTO can still bar such marks from registration. That issue is currently being litigated in the In Re Brunetti case in the Federal Circuit, which the Federal Circuit actually put on hold pending the outcome of Simon's case to see what the Supreme Court would do. The Brunetti case involves a different kind of mark, one that's squarely within not the disparaging part, but the scandalous or immoral part, I think. And it is a mark that is, I believe, spelled F-U-C-T.
C-T.
Yes. Yep. So that is what they are attempting to register. And the constitutionality, I guess, of the scandalous and immoral portion of 2A is squarely at issue in Brunetti. But does this case decide Brunetti, Mike? What do you think?
I think it does decide Brunetti, even though it wasn't squarely at issue. Mm-hmm. In the Brunetti case that is, as you mentioned, kind of wending its way through the Federal Circuit, the federal government had actually filed a brief in that case in light of the Federal Circuit's decision in Simon's case, and said, you know, we don't really see a way to distinguish between the immoral and scandalous provision and the disparagement clause that was struck down by the Federal Circuit. So I think from the federal government's perspective, at least in Brunetti, they were having a hard time distinguishing a difference or a different rationale for how you could maintain the immoral or scandalous provision, yet at the same time strike down the disparagement provision. And I agree with that. I think that the immoral scandalous provision is pretty much gone.
But Matt, as a law student, are you a little surprised that the court was not more precise in its language here and didn't say exactly what portions of Section 2A, or if it's striking the entirety of 2A that it is doing so, are constitutionally problematic?
Not particularly surprised. I think that there's two reasons. Is that one is that most of the Supreme Court clerks and justices do not have extensive IP experience. And so I think that in some ways they wander a little bit more there. But also that unlike in other areas of the law, due to Justice Scalia's influence largely, we've gone to a construction of our amendments that is based on the time of their founding. The First Amendment is something that we've totally drifted from. Largely, I think it's a wonderful thing, and I agree with the outcome. But we're not applying the original basis, which is how we have libel laws and how we have defamation laws, is that you are allowed to say things, and but they, you could be fined, you could be jailed afterwards. That changed, and I believe it was mentioned in the article, with the Abrams decision, Justice Holmes's dissent, and it has continued to increase our rights to free speech within this country. I think that is generally like a much more principled understanding, and you know, Justice Holmes talked about the marketplace of ideas, and I think in order to be a free country, we need to have that flourish. But the court itself struggles because it's not a textual reading of the First Amendment. So I'm less surprised that it drifts.
So Simon, you're obviously thrilled to have won this case that you have struggled with, all along here. Before I ask you my next question, we should ask you what personal toll, this has taken on you. How many years have you been involved in this? I read that, the case became handled pro bono for you just 6 years ago. So how were you able to forge ahead before that even happened?
Well, it's been a long journey for sure. And it feels like, you know, I'm totally relieved that it's finally over. If you count the time period that I started speaking with an attorney about filing, it's been close to 8 years for this entire process from start to finish, which is, you know, really interesting because when I first was recommended to file a registration, my attorney, who's a good friend of mine, said, you know, this thing's really easy to do. It'll be over in a few months. It's only going to cost you a few hundred bucks. It turned out a little differently than that. But yeah, I actually left being a full-time musician to take multiple jobs, second, third, fourth jobs, in order to afford the legal fees. And even though it was pro bono for around the year two mark, I was still responsible for something called appellate printing, which I did not know was a thing until I started getting these very, very large bills for it, court fees and other things like that. So certainly the financial piece of it was a bit burdensome, but I think the more difficult thing was how it affected my art, how it affected the band, you know, because the court case really became a big distraction. I would oftentimes have to make decisions like, do I pay this court fee or do I repair a tour bus? Do I spend my time trying to get amicus briefs filed or do I work on writing music? And on top of that, just that kind of the emotional toll of constantly being accused of being racist towards my own people, my own family, or, you know, in recent years, being insensitive or racist towards Native Americans and their particular campaign to get the Washington football team's name changed, a campaign that I've been supporting for almost a decade myself. So it's just been this really complex set of social issues. And not only that, but you know, the court and the USPTO would oftentimes use things that I would tweet out or write or anything, including you know, other folks that do that too. So just living under a microscope for almost a decade, where every one of my statements or actions would be questioned, that could be challenging, and I wouldn't wish that upon anybody.
No, nor would I. You were leading into right where I wanted to go next, which is now that you've won the case, is obviously it's bittersweet because it's been a long battle to get here. But is the victory itself a little bittersweet in that it may mean that in addition to the kind of mark that you are using, we may see some just flat out awful marks getting through and perhaps more of them than have done so in the past, since the provision that would have prevented them is now out the door constitutionally? How does that leave you?
You know, to be honest with you, it is sometimes a little uncomfortable, but that's the First Amendment for you, that oftentimes it protects the speech of those you disagree with the most. But the reality is that, like, as a person of color, as a member of a marginalized community, our biggest struggles aren't against trademark registrations. Our biggest struggles have to do with institutionalized and systemic discrimination. In this particular case, we found that there was a disparate impact on 2A, that it was disproportionately used against people of color and members of the LGBTQ community, because we tend to be the very groups that reappropriate language, which make us prime targets for the law itself. And I realized over the years that we can't be so obsessed with trying to punish villainous characters where we're willing to accept that the collateral damage would be experienced by already burdened communities. And just think about the appeals process. Nobody ever has won on appeal against an accusation of 2A. The closest to it was San Francisco's Dykes on Bikes, but they only had the objection withdrawn. So there was no precedent set. And the toll it takes, the resources it takes of going through this extremely degrading process of trying to prove you're not offensive to yourself, it's a bit absurd. And at the end of the day, it's not like our expenses are reimbursed. It's not like at the end of the day the trademark office issues an apology to your community for getting it wrong. They just say, okay, here's your trademark registration, and they move on to the next case. Again, most likely subjectively denying or enforcing that provision as well. And my opinion is that if the government was truly sincere about fighting racism, while using the trademark office as its vehicle to do so, why not begin by canceling the registrations of numerous white supremacist groups like the KKK? Why pick on an anti-racist Asian American ban instead?
Yes, exactly. And I have been trying to wrap my head around, my own personal feelings about the decision. I'm thrilled for you and have had a bit of consternation about, okay, what does this mean now for our society? And are we really going to see some marks and brands and things, named things that, show that we are in some sort of societal decline, that really you just don't want to see around. And, yes, free speech is wonderful and it needs to be protected, and you need to protect the speech, even of those that you hate. That's a core tenet of our society, but it doesn't mean that, for one thing, I think that there is a discussion to be had about whether something's brand is necessarily in all cases speech. I'm much more able to wrap my head around having the name of the Slants be speech than I am having the name of the Redskins be speech, partially because of the differing motivations there. So I've been sort of struggling internally with this, and I saw my favorite answer to that whole problem, whether there's, still ambiguity in the decision about whether scandalous and immoral can still be invoked or not. The answer was published this morning by a lawyer named John Blattner, who has an article at the National Law Review called Three Questions from the Supreme Court's Decision on Offensive Trademarks. And what he essentially says to my concern is, don't worry too much about the adverse impacts of the Mittal v. Tam decision, because the USPTO is just so, so broken that it's not going to get any worse now than it's already been. Here's what he writes. To the extent that some businesses do want to use such trademarks, there has never been any impediment to using such trademarks with or without registration. And besides, many of them have already succeeded in registering their trademarks. The Trademark Office has been notoriously inconsistent in its application of Section 2A. There are dozens of duly registered trademarks that would qualify as offensive one way or another. It is probably inevitable that there will be some increase in the number of applications for disparaging, immoral, or scandalous trademarks in the wake of the Slants decision. But the fact that so many marks of this kind have already achieved registration undermines the notion that there is a huge backlog of them ready to flood the trademark office. So I think what Mr. Blattner is telling us here is that don't expect consistency with or without this provision of law for the USPTO to hang its decisions on. Mike, do you agree with him?
I really do. I mean, I think that although I think there's a reasonable argument to be made that we probably will see more applications with offensive, maybe in some cases exceedingly offensive and just terribly disparaging applications come through, I think it's important to temper that fear with the reality of how the trademark system works. You know, it's not a vanity contest when you go to get trademarks. You just don't get a trademark because you want one. You actually have to show that you're using that in commerce and you're using it in a manner to distinguish your goods or services from some other third party. And so, you know, it's not like you just go and get a trademark one day because you want it. You have to establish that you're entitled to it. And so I don't know that we're going to see a huge amount of disparaging trademark applications, because at the end of the day, these folks that are going to register them have to be using them in commerce with a going concern. And I'm just not sure that there's a huge market for deeply offensive trademarks in commerce. Sure, there will be kind of those folks on the fringes of commerce that probably will register some offensive marks. But, you know, I think the downside to that is clearly outweighed by the upside.
Matt, I wonder if you have paid attention at all in going through this case and the commentary about it to this government speech issue that's at the heart of the Supreme Court's opinion. And it also came up in a case that we've discussed here on the show that involved the state of Texas and its ability to regulate what people put on vanity plates. And it determined that the government permitting people to have a license plate that said a certain thing was government speech. Here, the court takes great sort of ironic joy in saying the government is not speaking through every single trademark that is issued. The government doesn't want you to just do it. The government doesn't want you to, you know, name your catchphrase. That's not government speech. But do you think, Matt, that there's a case to be made that the issuance of the trademark itself is an act of speech?
And certainly that's the argument that the USPTO made. The Texas case was decided on a 5-4 decision with Justice Thomas joining the four more liberal Supreme Court members. And the decision, which I believe was written by Thomas, was a narrow decision, and it was decided that in making the license plates, that it had to be able to stop at some point, that this is something that's mandated by law in order to drive, that you have to be able to do this. And I think that is a really tough decision. Personally, I think it'd be better if we just didn't have all these various school logos and such on our license plate, and it would have made the decision a lot easier. But I think stickers on the car would have worked just fine, and that decision would have made a lot more sense. But inevitably, when the government allows for some people to speak and other people to not, it's kind of this tussle. If we allow Democrats to say something or we allow Republicans to say something, there's always people always feel disenfranchised when there isn't a quid pro quo, when even if they're not like basic anomalies. You know, some people have views that are incredibly negative towards other people, but they have the same like sense of outrage that they're not able to say something. So in the argument in the trademark instance was that we have to publish the United States PTO publishes the list of trademarks to other countries, and that somehow this affected the dignity of what the government was saying, and it was forced to say this to other countries. I think the court correctly decided that was rather ridiculous, that was not the same as having it on the license plate. I'm not sure how right that was. I think that that's just problematic when you have the license plate issue, whereas the PTO is something for protecting a property right in commerce.
Right. You know, Simon sadly needs to depart from us or else we would pick his brain all day. But we are going to let him go on his way. He's a busy guy and I'm sure has been through a lot and is exhausted as well. Before we let you go, Simon, we always do some resources of the week, a tip of the week, some stuff at the end of the show. And so before we let you go, we're going to do our resources of the week, which involve you and your band. Our resource of the week, of course, would be all of the Slants music, but in specifically the band Who Must Not Be Named, your EP, which is where you can find the Level Up song that we played a bit of before and many other great tracks. Also, we learned as we were starting the show that you guys, you're touring, actively touring, and you're going to be doing a performance in Chicago at Kent. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Sure. It's going to be a conference, Supreme Court IP Review, I think is what it's called. And so the band's going to be performing, and then I'll be on a panel talking about this case as well. And by then, I imagine there'll be a little bit more information of kind of like what the aftermath is post-Supreme Court decision. Of course, there's a lot of people excited about what's happening. One of our favorite IP Twitter handles from Ed Timberlake, he actually has something called the Daily Disparagement, where he kind of posts a new application every day from January 19th on that could be supposedly scandalous, immoral, or disparaging. So I think there's a lot of people kind of paying close attention to what's happening. But I think we also need to back up and see kind of the long-term effects of kind of revoking this provision of law, seeing what's going to happen with in terms of our society and what's going to happen in commerce. To me, I think I just did examining attorneys a huge favor because now they don't have to make these subjective decisions and go through this long arbitrary process. They can continue to meet their quotas by pumping out applications like before.
Right. So, Simon, I think you have 6 minutes left with us and we'll get you out of here on time. I've been doing most of the asking you questions. I want to kick it to Matt and Mike and let them pick your brain in the last few minutes we have with you because I know they have questions too.
So I'll go first. Simon, I know from some of our prior discussions, we talked about how your parents reacted to the Federal Circuit's decision. For our listeners, both of your parents are immigrants to the U.S. How do they feel about their son setting such an incredible precedent at the highest court in the land?
Well, for my father, he was actually worried because he came here as a political refugee, and he thought I was going to be sent to jail if I lost, or he was afraid that the government would punish me in some way. But when I explained to him that everything would be all right, that this is actually one of the constitutional protections we have in our government, then he said, go for it. You should fight. You should do what you think is right. For my mom, she called me on the day of the decision a few times, and I wasn't able to get back to her till later in the day. And she was like, your voicemail's full. I can't get a hold of you. And I was like, Mom, I've had like 40,000 messages. That's been a little wild. We talked for a while, and she congratulated me, but it was kind of bittersweet as well because she said, well, it's over now. She's like, I hope you can smile again. And I was like, what do you mean? And she said, you've been so unhappy these last few years. You've been so stressed. Like, you used to be like joke around all the time, be really happy. I hope you can be happy again. And so I didn't even realize like how much of a toll it was taking on me until my mom pointed it out, actually. So I think we're all just really glad that it's over. For them, they're kind of measuring stick of what's important in terms of news of the world is a newspaper from China. So when they saw that it was actually highlighted in the paper, they're like, oh, this must be a really big deal.
Wow.
Yeah, that's neat. Well, we're super thrilled for you and huge congratulations. I should mention to our listeners that we are going to host Simon and the Slants for another CLE like we did last year at our law firm up in Seattle. So Simon and I are still trying to work out the details, but we'll keep everybody posted. Should be a lot of fun.
Great. That will be a lot of fun. Matt, anything you need to get off your chest or ask Simon before we go ahead and let him go?
Simon, I think that you should find your way onto the Supreme Court somehow. And also, I think it would be if I could ever have one client with your sort of fortitude and just your awareness of your own rights and your willingness to stick it through, I think that would provide for a great career for me. So I just appreciate what you've done.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate that. I will say that it's not always been easy for the attorneys who represented me as well. I used to have my first attorney who kind of kicked off this entire process. I used to have him on speed dial. We would talk pretty often about the case because it was like this really kind of punk rock guerrilla style appeal. Like he kind of said, okay, I'm going to work pro bono on this, but you have to collect all of these legal declarations. You got to get me a survey. You got to get me a dictionary expert. You got to meet with community leaders. So it took me like every day I was contacting like dozens of people. And at one point I had to talk to about 140 social justice organizations. So I was like, okay, so they're all willing to write letters and support us. Like, who do you want? And he's just like, whoa, there's so much information. I don't know how to handle all of this. And of course, being very, very vocal about my own case and rights, it could be kind of like a double-edged sword as well. I know for a while, my attorneys at Archer, like, although they appreciated it, were also kind of like, hey, could you not speak about the case for now? we you know, the Supreme Court would rather you not kind of talk about the case, or we just want to kind of lay low for a while. So I had to pull back on my speaking appearances and that sort of thing and allow them to kind of finalize that legal strategy. But once we actually had oral arguments, once they were done, I was kind of free to speak about these things. And so our most recent tour that we went on, which was most of April and May, was a combination of me performing at concerts, rock clubs, and that sort of thing, and also speaking at a lot of different law schools and IP conferences, trying to give people the full context of what was happening. Because I think a lot of times you don't hear that backstory. You just kind of see these legal briefs, and they're almost cold and surgical. And you kind of think about law in these broad theories, but you don't necessarily think about the litigants involved. You know, people don't kind of really truly understand its impact of what it's like for a petitioner to go through this process. You know, I've spent a little bit over a fifth of my life in the legal system. And so that does, you know, kind of change a person for better or for worse. And I'm just trying to give more of that story, saying like, hey, you know, we're not just like this provocative, offensive band. We actually do a lot of anti-racism work. That's a big part of who we are and what we do. In fact, what's kind of funny is that a month before we went to the Supreme Court for oral arguments, I was emailed by the White House. They have this program called the White House Initiative of Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders. And I was asked to appear on an album with President Barack Obama, First Lady Michelle Obama, as well as numerous leaders in the Asian American community. They called us champions of the Asian American community and wanted to help them with this anti-bullying program. And I was like, yeah, that's fine. I was like, yo, Barack, can you do me a favor and just call the Department of Justice and have a conversation about this?
I'm having this red tape. I feel you could cut right through.
But, that's great. You know, that's just been a part of that journey. The entire time we've been fighting against the trademark office, other branches of the government have been using us. So the Department of Defense asked us to play for troops serving overseas. We played at maximum security prisons to try and reduce violence against Asian American inmates, and on kind of down the line, that's been a part of our journey. So I'm kind of, you know, deeply humbled that I was able to be a part of this larger conversation, and it's been exciting, but I'm really glad it's over. And now we can move forward with the rest of our work, and hopefully people can seriously consider things like racial identity and where those rights may lie for more marginalized communities who don't necessarily have that voice, as we consider law and all of its aspects and impacts on different groups.
That's so great, Simon. We're so excited and thrilled you were able to join us today. I echo your mother. I hope you can smile again. Thank you for coming with us and smiling about the outcome today and sharing your personal thoughts and insights.
Sure. Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome.
Thank you, Simon. Thanks, Simon.
We'll go ahead and let Simon go while we wrap up this abbreviated special episode of This Week in Law. My gosh, guys, what a treat. Thank you so much, Mike, for setting that
Incredible.
Up.
Incredible.
Yeah.
I'm so glad we could do it. And in addition to just really enjoying the conversation, I got some good legal advice from Simon, which I should now, when clients ask, well, how long will this trademark application take? I'll say, well, anywhere between 6 months and 8 years.
That's perfect. Perfect. And I didn't want to do
this. You might end up in your application may up. End up before the highest court in the land. Who knows?
Right. And you'll be responsible for appellate printing charges. I didn't want to do this while we were taking up Simon's time, but I did find that quote from the opinion where Justice Alito is having some fun with government speech. Here's what he says. In light of all this, it is far-fetched to suggest that the content of a registered, the content, notice he focuses on, the act of registration of a registered mark is government speech. If the federal registration of a trademark makes the mark government speech, the federal government is babbling prodigiously and incoherently. It is saying many unseemly things. It is unashamedly endorsing a vast array of commercial products and services, and it is providing Delphic advice to the consuming public. For example, if trademarks represent government speech, what does the government have in mind when it advises Americans to make believe? Sony. Think different. Apple. Just do it. Nike. Or have it your way. Burger King. What was the government warning about? Oh, was the government warning about a coming disaster when it registered the mark End Time Ministries?
Yeah, it's good stuff.
Yes, it is good stuff. People should read this decision and try and take it in. Definitely, I think, as we've talked about on the show before, a hard issue, but one that we're thrilled came out the way that it did. For Simon and the Slants. Mike, we made a promise last week while you were not with us.
Oh.
That promise, we're making our tip of the week now, and the tip would be make it rhyme. Mike, could you read us your poem?
Oh, my.
Could you read us
Dr. your Seuss?
Yes, about the case that we've discussed, the dispute that we've discussed between Comic Mix and Dr. Seuss. Fair use in the loose for the great Dr. Seuss.
I'd be happy to. I just need a moment to pull it up, if you can give me a moment.
Yes, I will, because we have another tip of the week. So I will go ahead and do the first one first, and then we'll get to you. The first one, something that happened this week that you may have stumbled on if you are a user of Google News. Google News completely revamped its interface this week. It looks clean and fresh and looks like something that would have been crafted in this decade. And that's all well and good. And it's also doing other well and good things like combating fake news. Definite steps ahead that it has done in its revamp of Google News. But if you are a daily Google News user, you have found occasion to be frustrated since the change, because two things that I use daily are not showing up anymore when you go to news.google.com. And those things involve the ability to sort results within a date range. So you do a search on a topic and you just want to see, for example, I quoted earlier an article that was just published this morning. The only way you can do that, I will clarify, they are sorting things in date range, but they're giving you the most recent first if you ask for that. But if you want to see something from the past week or the past year, that little drop-down menu that we've all come to know and love, that is gone unless, and here's the tip. If you want to keep using that, and if you want to keep using the ability to then, okay, I searched for this one string on Google News, and now I want to search for it on other Google properties. I want to look in videos. I want to look in Scholar. I want to look on the homepage. I want to look in shopping for whatever reason. Same search string. Instead of having to retype it in, you could always just click that little button at the top. That too is also gone from the new page. So the way you get those things back is you can still use Google News. Just start from the homepage first. Do your search on the homepage. Once you've gotten your homepage search result, then click on news. Then all of those features that you know and love will be available to you. It took me a while to puzzle that one out. And so if you hadn't puzzled it out and we're missing those things, they are still there for you. All right, Mike, are you ready?
I'm ready. So this is a post that I wrote about the case involving Dr. Seuss, a company called Comic Mix. We've talked about it before on the show. Comic Mix came up with a book called Oh, the Places You'll Boldly Go, which is a mashup of Star Trek and Dr. Seuss, and Dr. Seuss sued, and we have a ruling from the court on Comic Mix's motion to dismiss. So this is a blog post entitled Fair Use on the Loose for the Great Dr. Seuss. And it reads, you may remember, you may recall, a certain infringement suit filed last fall. It was filed by the heirs of the great Dr. Seuss. And now they've run smack dab into the doctrine of fair use. Let me tell you what happened. It's a tale worth telling. For the defendant is cheering and the plaintiff is yelling. How did the suit start? Why was the doc in a fix? It all started with the company called Comic Mix. They do mishups and mashups, wreaking havoc and heck. And their latest creation mixed Dr. Seuss with Star Trek. They gave it a title. It's truly one that you know. They called it, Oh, the Places You'll Boldly Go. The plaintiff did not like it, not one little bit, and they fussed and they fumed and were in quite a twit. So they filed a lawsuit with a big ferocious bark. Stop copying our work and infringing our mark. Copy, you say, defendant said with a hiss. We're going to file a motion to dismiss. And file they did under Rule 12b-6. Filed their motion, did Comic Mix. Perhaps to their surprise and their utter delight, the court said, hey, Comic Mix, you're largely right. The court said it was fair for the use of the mark. Those claims were gone, tossed into the dark. But the copyright claims, oh, those will stay for a while. Plaintiff holds on, and we'll take those to trial. The court plowed through fair use, plowed through like a tractor, and it all came down to that last fair use factor. The court said it wasn't clear if the market value was hurt. That's a question for the jury. It will be on alert. So the saga continues. There may be no truce, for fair use is on the loose. For the great Dr. Seuss.
Yay! Hey!
Thank you. Thank you.
Well done. Right. And thanks. Disclaim any and all abuse for your listening to Fair Use on the Loose for the great Dr. Seuss. What else do we have for you? We wouldn't do a show without giving you a selfie of the week. And this one is a local one for me, so I'm kind of excited about it. An animal selfie of the week. Here we go. So this is a sea lion at the Aquarium of the Pacific, just up the road, who has been taught, I guess they use these sticks to have them put their nose on a target and get fed, get treats. So they're used to these sticks, and the sticks are neutrally buoyant, I think. So they are able to allow the sea lion to carry a camera around without any, you know, harm or stress to the sea lion. And now the sea lion can swim around and give you a tour of its new habitat at the Aquarium of the Pacific. So that is an actual animal selfie with the animal as cinematographer and capturing itself and its surroundings in the video being filmed. So hooray for the Aquarium of the Pacific and our animal selfie of the week. And let's see. I think we've hit everything we wanted to hit. We had some music things we hoped to go through with Simon, but it was far more interesting to talk with him about his case and everything he's been through there. So I'm glad we did that. We will be off next week. We hope that you enjoy a wonderful holiday weekend for the 4th of July here in the U.S. We'll be dark next week, but back on the 14th, where we will be recording at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC on Friday the 14th, which is when we do the show on Fridays. If you can tune in with us live, that's great. We hope that you can. If not, go on over to our webpage at twit.tv/twill, where our entire archive of shows resides for you. With that, I guess we'll go ahead and wrap up this show. Anything you want to add, Mike, before we conclude?
That was just a lot of fun today. I'm so thrilled that Simon could be with us. And I wish everybody a happy and healthy and fun 4th of July.
Yes, me too. And Matt, anything you want to leave folks with as we sashay off here?
No, I think that was just a great pleasure to hear Simon talk about his life and experience. And I think that's a good feeling to go into this 4th of July weekend with.
Me too. Thanks so much, everyone, for joining us. Please do continue to get in touch with us between the shows. I'm Denise at twit.tv. Matt is MattC at twit.tv. Mike is Mike at twit.tv. Find us on Twitter, on Facebook. Let us know what's on your minds, what you think. If you have any interpretation of Mattal versus Tam that you would like to share with us, or any take on the fallout of the case, we'd love to hear what you think is going to happen. Do get in touch with us, and we will let you know how we feel about how you feel. And we'll see you next time on This Week in Law. Take care.